We continue in our C.S. Lewis study in Book 2, Chapter 1, What Christians Believe. Last time we were talking about things that Lewis said that Christians do not believe, and that is that all other religions are completely wrong through and through, or rather Christianity doesn't have to believe that. We talked about pantheists. We talked about polytheists. We talked a little about monotheists last week. We did not get to talking about atheism and these rival conceptions of God. Are there particular questions or comments that you might have related to last week before we begin moving forward here in chapter 1 and into chapter 2 in these rival conceptions of God? Okay. We did say last time that the whole idea of good and evil is pretty much a human distinction, because God, in the Christian tradition, God is beyond that in some ways, but in the pantheistic tradition, God is totally beyond choosing good and evil and making that determination. For Christians, we believe that God made the world and everything around. God created space and time, and Lewis addresses that here in chapter 1, that God created space and time, hot and cold, simply as a will of mind. That is, God thought it up. It came from God's intellect. It came from God's thought process. And then the universe, and in particular our world and everything else, and the concepts that we have, were created from God's intellect and God's mind, and what God would like to have done. Now, within the Christian position, we believe that God is good and God made things good, but many things have gone wrong. And we talked a little bit at the end of last week. God wanted to make things go right. Why did they go wrong? And the first thing that y'all came up with was the first thing that I would have said, and what Lewis gives us an indication of, that is choice. Free to choose. And that's what went wrong. Lewis initially goes on to say, you know, initially in his atheism, he thought that it was much simpler and much easier just to believe that there was no intelligent being behind all of this. Therefore, it was easier to doing that, to think of that, it was easier to say that the world was not made by an intelligent being, there was no intelligent design behind it whatsoever, because then you get out of all the Christian arguments about why there has to be a God. One of the Christian philosophers in the Scholastic period, by the name of Anselm, wrote an ontological proof for the existence of God. There's much more to it than what I'm going to say. The book's about yay thick. But Anselm basically argues that if you look at everything around and the way things work in the universe and in human life and in nature around us, that God must exist, because it makes no sense that God would not exist given the order of things, given the order of the world. And just simply to have things come into being makes absolutely no sense. So his ontological argument is God has to exist because it's totally absurd to think that all this order would come about and intelligence would come about simply by chance. So it's much more ridiculous to believe that God doesn't exist than that God does. Yes, Wesley?
Put all religion aside and put everything else aside that we've got today and just look at the world as it exists, how can you build enough like it?
Okay, that's true. And in case this mic didn't pick you up, I should have gotten that one over there. But that's true. Put everything, all religions aside, everything else aside, look at the way the world is, and that's what he's saying here, the way the world operates and functions. How could you not believe that it was just chance, that there wasn't a God or a being whom we call God and believe is God? And that's very, very true. But Lewis goes on to say that makes things much more difficult for the atheist to try and say, well, there's no intelligent being behind all of this, and then turn around and look at the order. But even more than that, he goes on to say, you know, atheism says there is no God, but he found himself thinking that the universe is cruel and unjust, and a lot of the things that happen in our world are cruel and unjust. Not just people doing that, but diseases and other things. It's just cruel and unjust. And then he got to thinking, what? Where did my idea of cruel and unjust originate? How do I know what's cruel and what's not? How do I know what is just and what is unjust? And he said that kind of created a problem for him as an atheist, because what that said to him was, then there has to be something out there or someone out there that set that standard and that set those boundaries and that gave him and gave us as a whole the understanding of what is good and what is bad. Of course, I used a little example toward the end of last time from the movie Old God Book 2 with George Burns, and talking about saying, you know, he never, as God, saying he never could create anything with just one side to it. How would he know it's good if you didn't have bad? How would he know it was pleasure if you didn't have pain? You know, all of these things. Not a front without a back. That'd be really strange. But you would be a but even a flounder's got a back. It's just got those two eyes on the front in an odd place. He said, you know, you really have no bases for cruel or wrong or bad if there's no intelligent being behind it all. If there's not someone or something that created it. Therefore, there must be a God who gives good and right, and who gives us an understanding of cruel and wrong, or bad and wrong. He goes on to write and say, if the whole of reality is senseless, but one part, like his idea of justice, makes sense, then that shoots his argument in the foot. Or worse places. Because if anything makes sense, when he thinks the world is senseless, then there has to be someone or something behind it that gave it that sense. And he talks here in this quote late in the chapter that's on this handout from the other week. My argument against God was that the universe seemed so cruel and unjust, but how had I got this idea? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust? If the whole show was bad and senseless from A to Z, so to speak, why did I, who was supposed to be part of the show, find myself in such violent reaction against it? What he said there is, if there was nobody behind it, and everything was bad from start to finish, then why did it bother me that everything's bad from start to finish? If everything's cruel from start to finish, why does it bother me, if that's the way it's supposed to be by chance? And he said, so that bothered me to the point where I said, well, there has to be something behind all of this. You know, he said, my idea of justice, I could have given up my idea of justice by saying it was nothing but a private idea of my own, but if I did that, my argument against God collapses too, for the argument depended on saying that the world was really unjust, not simply that I didn't like that idea, it didn't fit my fancy, and so I came up with the idea. He said, and basically saying, I'm not intelligent enough to do that. As a human being, he's not intelligent enough to make that determination. So he said that even though in my act of trying to prove God did not exist, that all of reality was senseless, I found I was forced to assume that that one part of reality, my idea of justice, was full of sense. Consequently, atheism turns out to be too simple. If the whole universe has no meaning, we should never have found out that it has no meaning. Follow that? If the universe has no meaning to it at all, he said, then we should know that it has no meaning. Simply the fact that we have come to realize that there is meaning, and if there is meaning, then the opposite of that is no meaning at all. Simply the fact that we've come to that means that there has to be an intelligent being that created that and gave us the sense to understand it and set that standard for us. So, atheism, he said, is too simple. But he also says in the next chapter that a lot of Christianity is too simple, right? A lot of what we put out there is way too simple. He starts in chapter 2 very simply by saying, very well then, atheism is too simple. And I will tell you another view that is also too simple. It is the view I call Christianity and water. The view which simply says there is a good God in heaven, everything's all right, leaving out all the difficult and terrible doctrines about sin and hell and the devil and redemption. If there's no sin, he's saying, then why is there a need for redemption? if we make it out to be so simple that it's like a child's religion, then we really don't have any depth to religion at all, and we can't begin to understand God as we should. We can't begin to understand God as we should. Because, quite frankly, is reality simple? He argues no. We might think it's simple. He uses a table, I'll use this chair. What is this chair made of? A lot of people said metal. Someone said atoms. Atoms that are held together in a particular way, conform in a particular way, and quite frankly, though this thing looks solid and feels solid, there's actually a lot of space in there. There's a lot of unfilled space. If you were to sit down with a scientist and look at atoms and the way everything goes together, actually, well, I don't know if I ought to say that or not. There's a whole lot of space in us, too. That's right. Some more than others, Wesley. A lot of us, we got, you know, my youngest brother, Phil, one time when he was young, we were riding along on vacation. He was going to tell my mother a secret. And so he leaned up to tell her a secret, and he went to whisper in her ear and stuck his finger in the other ear. He was like 4 years old. So it's really not that simple. We think it's simple to make this chair or to describe this chair as being metal, but if you talk to a scientist, you'll find out it's not all that simple. We think of lasers now. I mean, these days we think of lasers as something that's a great invention. It's really simple, all that kind of stuff, and laser pointers and all that. We can put them in little bitty things. Go to Furman University and talk to Charles Townes, who invented the maser and the laser, and ask him how simple it is. And you'll probably come away with your head spinning from everything that is said. So if reality is not simple, how can we anticipate or expect religion if it is going to take us from childhood through adulthood to be simple? I mean, it's a lot of folks want it to be simple. A lot of folks will tell you, even today, there are a lot of folks that will tell you they don't want to have to think about religion. They don't want to have to think about God. Just tell me what I'm supposed to believe, how I'm supposed to believe it, and then leave me alone. I can go about the rest of my living counting on what you told me I'm supposed to believe. Put it in simple terms. Well, we can try to put it in simple terms for children, yes. But even the biblical writers talk about there comes a point in time where we need to move beyond the simple. We need to move beyond childish things and childhood things to that which is much more complex to understand God. You know, Lewis says, a child saying a prayer looks simple. And if you're content to stop there, well and good. But if you're not, and the modern world, and I would say the postmodern world today, usually it's not. If you want to go on and ask what is really happening, you've got to be prepared for something difficult. And I know there's a typo in here. If we ask for something more than simplicity, it is silly, not sully. It is silly, then, to complain that the something more is not simple. I would say, in other words, going deeper in study and understanding the teachings more gets you into more questions. The longer I'm in what I do, the more questions I come up with, and the fewer set answers I find. I'm a whole lot better at questions than I am at giving you a definitive answer on a lot of things. And the more I see in the world, and the more I deal with religion, not just Christianity, but religion as a whole, the more questions I have. I wish it were more simple. But it's not. Now, he says that this procedure is often used by people who want to destroy Christianity, and they set up a child's version, in other words, in order to create a straw man they tear down easily. But, you know, we do that with a lot of other different things. And there are people in other religions that do the same thing. And atheists do the same thing. They set up a child's version of Christianity so that they can very easily poke holes in it and tear it down, set fire to it. Christians do that. Rather than getting into all the nuances of another denomination, we've got one that we really don't agree with and we really don't like, and so we'll set up a childhood or a childish version of that denomination so we can poke holes in it and then consign them to hell. If you don't think Christians do that, I can tell you some places to go and you'll find it very quickly. Even to the point, if you don't interpret this verse like I did, then you don't believe anything and you're going to hell. Hands down. But many Christians still want the child's version. So we don't have to deal with the hard questions. I'm finding that more and more these days because people are out there, and the way the world runs these days, all the questions that are raised by the way the world runs and all the things that seem to be going wrong and seem to be going on, and people are nervous at work and they're nervous at home and they're nervous at school and they don't know what's going to happen next. They want to have some place where they can go and sit and have somebody tell them exactly what they have to think, and then they can go home and not worry about it. Not only that, if then they run into difficulty and they can't answer questions or something goes wrong, they can always say, well, you know, so-and-so told me. Instead of taking upon themselves. Because if we take more than a child's version of our religion, of our Christianity, if we look for more, if we're not satisfied with simply a childish or a child's version, then that means we have to take some responsibility. And we got so many responsibilities out there, we just don't want to do that, do we? And what if I'm wrong? What if I'm wrong? What if I'm wrong in thinking this way rather than that way? I hope if it's not an intentional attempt at being wrong that we, I mean, we do talk about a forgiving God, right? Who will guide us, but who will also forgive some of those wrongs. But Lewis says when you try to explain adult Christian doctrine, what happens? When you try to dig deeper and you try to get people to ask questions or people start asking questions, what happens? Man, it's too complicated. It's too hard. It makes my head hurt. I got some books over there that make my head hurt to read. But I also know why some of those folks that wrote those books think the way that they do, and if I ever run into somebody else that does, I know why I disagree with them, or why I agree with them, or why I'm not too sure. Because I've at least taken the time to investigate it. More and more these days, people are we're running up against not only various world religions, but different practices within Christian tradition that we don't necessarily think go together, and people are trying to put them together, and then when we say, well, why did you do that? They start saying, well, I don't know. And what do you think about them when they say, well, I don't know why. Just somebody did it. Not very deep. Not very good reason for doing that. I'll digress for a moment, but I have been amazed in the last several years with the groups that call themselves postmodern, and especially a lot of college students and just beyond, who don't want to have anything to do with traditional, organized religion. We're spiritual, but we're not religious, and we don't want to have anything to do with tradition. But then they'll turn around and have their Bible study groups at home with incense and candles and chants going on and Gregorian chants in the background. You can't get much more traditional than that. But they don't see anything wrong. They miss the connection. It doesn't connect, and it doesn't connect with them that, wait a minute, we said this, but we're doing this. We need to understand more about our tradition as well as other traditions so that we understand where we come from, why we got there. I'll ask. You don't have to answer. But how many people in this room were raised Baptist? Bunch of folks. I know some of you weren't. That's okay. How many people in this room are Baptist primarily because you were raised Baptist, and that's all you know. A few of you will raise your hands. Before I started doing what I do, I would have said the same thing. I would have raised my hand because and my daddy was a deacon. We went on vacations with the preacher and his family. And most of the times, those were down to Fort Caswell, which was the Baptist State Convention Center on the coast across the river, Cape Fear River, from Southport. It was an old Civil War fort. So when we talk about being raised in the church, I was right up there with the preacher's kids. But I have come to determine that I remain a Baptist of sorts, because that's what I want to be, not because that's necessarily how I was raised. I can tell you all kinds of things that different Christian traditions believe and different world religions believe, but I still choose to remain a Baptist. And it gets pretty philosophical out there sometimes as to why. But, you know, try to explain adult Christian doctrine and people say it's too complicated. It needs to be more simple. And there is a simplicity to it, a foundation that is somewhat simple, but then if we're going to live out that Christianity, it becomes more complicated. If we're going to understand the callings, plural, that come in our lives, because at different stages in our lives, we have different callings sometimes. We may have one particular calling that runs throughout, but it changes over time. The complexity sometimes changes. And if we're going to do that, then we need to move from a child's perspective to a more adult perspective, even though oftentimes it is scary. Oftentimes it is scary. I know of a lot of folks that say they wish they could go back and just be a child again, because life was so much simpler. I've run into folks in the hospital. I've run into students who've said that. I've had counseling sessions with folks in the last couple of years where they have said, I just wish I could go back to when it was a whole lot simpler, because this is just too complicated. And yet they would not be who they are if they did. I think Lewis makes a pretty profound statement when he says, their idea of making religion simple is as if religion were something God invented and not His statement to us of certain quite unalterable facts about His nature. How do you relate to that statement? Anybody? How do you understand that statement? Some people think religion was something God invented rather than God's statement of certain unalterable facts about God's nature. Okay, I'll let that sit on you a minute or two there.
We tend to overcomplicate things and not just take it for what it's worth. And I guess to me the reference that would come to my mind is John 3:16-17, where, you know, basically God so loved the world that He sent His only begotten Son. And whosoever believes in Him shall not perish, but have everlasting life. And that the world not be condemned, but be saved through Him. I think it just gets down to that. As long as you believe, then you're saved. And I think the other is just, you can make it as complicated as you want to.
Well, and I would agree to, you know, to the foundational statements about God doing that, and Jesus came not to condemn us, but to save the world. But then Jesus did something more than just that in His death, burial, and resurrection, because we then look to the way Jesus lived, which makes things a little more complicated. Because the way He approached Judaism and learned everything He could, and He was regular in the synagogue even from when He was a child. He thought about it regularly, and when he could hold his own as far as asking intelligent questions and giving intelligent answers, when the rabbis started discussing points of theology and points of practice, and they were not impressed with Jesus at age 12 because he was giving them what for and starting a new religion. They were impressed with Jesus because he knew so much, and he was not functioning as a typical 12-year-old. He was functioning with questions and understanding that were beyond a child's years. That's right, Melissa. It does have to do with relationship. Yeah, and that's where it gets more complicated. But then again, relationships.
But that's not necessarily within the church of God. That's our own personal relationship.
That's our personal relationship. But that does have a connection to church and doctrine and understanding. I will just speak up for me personally. I have no really simple relationships. True relationships, the longer you have them, the more, and I would put quotes around the word, but the quotation marks, but the more complicated.
The deeper they are.
Right. There's more involved, the more complicated or involved they get.
Complex,
yes, that's a very good word. The more complex they get. Even with that little 2-year-old, the relationship is changing. It's evolving, and will be more complex as time goes along. Boy, Stephen doesn't know what he's in for. Although he said when she's allowed to start dating when she's 30, that he's going to make sure every time some 30 or 31 year old shows up at the door, he's going to be cleaning his .40 caliber pistol and ask him what his intentions are.
If we only had the gospel without the
without Paul complicating things,
if we only had the gospels without Paul's complications, how would we view Christianity then?
That's a very good question, because quite frankly, Paul wrote everything he wrote prior to the Gospel of Mark being written. And there are people who would contend, and in some instances rightly so, that the Christianity that is currently practiced and has been practiced most has more to do with Paul's understanding and interpretation than it does with the very teachings of Jesus themselves. Yet, even with Paul's understanding, there are touch points in many of the teachings of Jesus. You know, most everything Jesus taught has a foundation or a kernel somewhere, that's K-E-R-N-E-L, somewhere in the law or the prophets. And he builds upon that. So it's tied very much to his Judaism and beyond. Paul was raised a Pharisee, so there are a number of touch points in there. Jesus makes such statements as... to seek, ask, or ask, seek, and knock, and to enter by the narrow gate, not the broad gate. And Paul says such things as study to show yourself approved, a workman. Jesus says, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, or who says the creed so many times a day, or whatever. But only those who do the will of the Father who sent me. James says, faith without works is dead. People say, Martin Luther said, oh, well, James doesn't belong in there because Paul said it's only through faith. But Paul says, there's a new law, faith working through love. And in several other places, Paul connects belief with practice. So I think without Paul, some things might not be quite as complicated. But if we dig deep enough into Jesus' teachings, the relationship is going to become more complex and complicated. Because the standard we have to live up to is not Paul. the standard out there is Jesus.
So since all of the Gospels were written,
Mark was written after Paul's letters, but close enough in time to where not all of Paul's letters are circulated everywhere.
What I'm saying is, yeah. I wonder how much his teaching influenced the writing of the Gospel.
His teachings, without a doubt, influenced Luke, because Luke wrote the Gospel of Luke and Book of Acts and knew Paul. But then again, Luke was influenced by, and see, this is another place. Mark records pretty much the teachings as remembered by Simon Peter, if we hold the tradition that John Mark was the scribe of Simon Peter. Tradition says Matthew was Levi, who was one of the disciples. Tradition says John may have been one of the disciples as well. Luke says, I know that there are other things that have been written and people have been going around talking about this, so I did a whole bunch of research before I sat down to write. So Luke's saying right there, I've been influenced not just by Peter or John, but Paul, and I think there's a chance that Luke may have even interviewed Mary, the mother of Jesus, because there are a couple of places where Luke writes, but Mary kept these things within her heart and pondered them. How does he know that if he didn't have some connection? And he says right up front, I didn't just take it carte blanche that somebody said it and therefore that made it right. Luke said, I went out and I dug around and I did some research and now I'm putting this stuff together as best I understand it. From doing that, Luke, that early Gentile Christian, didn't go with a child's version. Luke helped to add some complicating factors to it by saying, you know, it's more. It is about relationship, and it becomes more complex and complicated as things go along. What we have in the Gospel of John, in the prologue, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God, and not anything that was made without Him. And then eventually says that Word, that divine Logos, became enfleshed or incarnate in Jesus. And I've talked this so much I could, in my sleep, rattle off the theologian's name and it just passed right by. So fast it was a blur. But one theologian over a century ago said that what we have in John 1, 1 through 18 is the most complete and the most full statement about the true nature of God anywhere in the New Testament in Jesus. And that Jesus is the ultimate fulfillment and the ultimate revealer of God's nature and who God is compared or in relationship to His creation. Love and care and concern to the point that God Himself gives. God Himself comes in that divine Logos. And God Himself lives life as we do. And as Lewis says, you know, really, if you think about it, Christianity, you know, reality's odd, but Christianity is a religion that nobody should have guessed would have been this way. I mean, who would have made it up? Who would have thunk it? God incarnate. I mean, we've got the incarnation. That's not canned milk is. We've got God in the flesh. In Jesus, paying the price for what we owe God. Love and obedience is all that He asks in return. We owe more than we can pay. God Himself paid what we owed. And even more. Who would have come up with that on their own? Nobody, really. It's God's own nature and God's own life. And Paul writes about it in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, speaking of Paul. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1, starting in verse 17, "For Christ did not send me to baptize, but to proclaim the gospel, and not with eloquent wisdom, so that the cross of Christ might not be emptied of its power. For the message about the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning I will thwart. Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God the world did not know God through that wisdom, God decided through the foolishness of our proclamation to save those who believe. And what is that foolishness? The cross. A sign of weakness, a sign of disdain. Even within Judaism, the Hebrew scriptures say, cursed is anyone who hangs upon a tree. Who in the world, other than God, would have come up with such a system? Christianity is a religion that no one should have guessed. Because why? Christianity has to come from the mind of God. What God did, what God thought of, has to come from the mind of God. Yes, you may. If we're so compassionate, you know, why do we kill each other? Why do we do horrible things? It comes back down to God. And Lewis talks about how, you know, we as Christians think, you know, God made everything, created that which was good. And if you go to the Hebrew Scriptures, after God creates humanity in the younger version of creation, chapter 1, God declares everything's very good. But then God, according to those traditions and according to Jewish understanding, for the most part, God gave us then the ability to choose. God took a chance and said, okay, you can choose to be obedient or you can choose not to be obedient. We are Christians, but that we're still human beings. We're Christians, but we're still human beings. We're still flawed human beings. Once we sin, do we ever cease to become a sinner just because we get forgiveness? No. We're sinners. I don't want to really jump into it so much because next week, finishing this up and going to chapter 3, I wanted to talk some about free choice versus predeterminism and infralapsarianism and supralapsarianism. Two big words, supralapsarianism and infralapsarianism. Infralapsarianism, and we'll talk about this again next week, basically says that God decided to create the universe and then gave humans free choice, and God waited to see if we would choose to be righteous or unrighteous, to obey or disobey, gave us that ability, and then once we did that, God then chose to save some and not others. So it was once we proved our nature of free choice, then God said, okay, now I'm going to predetermine the elect and those that are not. Supralapsarianism is that God decided before the creation that in creating, God was going to save some, elect some, and damn others, and therefore God even planned the fall, right down to its very detail. He didn't allow us, it was in the plan. So that God could then save some, condemn others, and the fact that we all needed to be condemned and God chose to save some shows God's love and compassion, because God chose to save some when we all should die. Interesting concept that God would plan the fall as well, so that then God could prove to us that God was magnanimous. Whatever that is. Well, that depends on if we're spiritual beings, and when we die, and then when the judgment happens for us, which New Testament says it's appointed on the man wants to die, and then the judgment. And then in other places it says it's at the end of the world. But whenever that happens, we should, at least in our limited human understanding, if we're going to have some kind of body, then there's also some kind of pain or some kind of pleasure to be experienced as well. although there are those who simply say the worst hell would be never to be remembered at all, even by God, and to cease to exist. But that's part of our overall nature, and the blend. That's a paradox. It's not two doctors, but a paradox that we have in being spiritual as well as physical beings, and being trapped. Well, there will be no reason for marriage and having kids because God's already done that. Contrary to what some of the Mormon beliefs and others are, but the world is a battlefield. The world is a battlefield, and a battlefield between good and bad. And Lewis says the universe is full of things that are obviously bad. But how do we know they're bad if we don't have something good? And dualism posits that there is black and white, cut and dried, good and evil, no shades of gray. A lot of Christians would like for that to be, and sometimes we try to make it that way without recognizing the shades of gray in the middle. But that also lends some understanding of how we view those powers and how we view their connection to God or not. And that's where we'll pick up next week, because I've already run over 3 minutes. That's where we'll pick up next week and move into chapter 3, where we talk some more about this whole idea of alternatives and free choice or not and other things. May God give you grace. May God give you compassion. Not just for yourselves, but may God give it to us so that we may share it with others. God bless you. Go in peace. Amen.